On this episode of Baseball Barbicast, we preview Rivalry Weekend. MLB has introduced a new thing, and we kind of like it. We draft all the rivalries ahead of the weekend. Then we go around the league, talk about the Dodgers, talk about the Red Hot Twins and Cardinals. Which one of those teams do we believe in? And then it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly, and oh so ugly it will be. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbicast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbicast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that every weekend is rivalry weekend. If you're a hater, I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Really, it should be revelry weekend.
Ooh, I like the suggestion. Yes, we are going to talk about all these big rivalries that stretch back so many years, right? We will talk about a new initiative for Major League Baseball that has dictated the schedule this weekend. I'm looking forward to that. We got some Dodgers chat, of course. We have to say farewell to some folks retiring, as well as someone who we don't know if he's retiring, but we also don't know if he's going to play for another Major League Baseball team.
And Austin then Barnes.
Friday. Oh, the good, the bad, the ugly. I'm so excited as always. What a way to finish the week. But Jake, as you mentioned, it is Rivalry Weekend, and that is our opener.
Hey.
We have a new baseball thing.
Can I read it straight from the press release?
Please, please do. I was going to say, I was wanting to say like, oh, this has to be sponsored by something. And I do see that it is, but that's not our problem.
Welcome to Rivalry Weekend. For the very first time, MLB is highlighting some top geographical rivalries and the Red Sox Braves with Rivalry Weekend presented by No Free Ads. Every team will play its designated rival with 11 interleague series and 4 non-interleague matchups. Yeah. So why here is obvious. One, anything to break up the season, MLB loves to do. Anything that you can slap a No Free Ads on makes sense. And this is a silly shtick that we are in favor of.
Yes, it absolutely.
It is an undoubtable, complete pro thing.
Yeah, because it will provide us some entertaining matchups that, you know, we don't get to see that often. Now, it is more common than it used to be, of course, to see these interleague matchups. And I think that that is what the league wanted to lean into here, right? Is while it does feel a little silly to call to have a rivalry weekend without like Dodgers, Giants, and Red Sox, Yankees, like if you just went to a casual sports fan and be like, hey, baseball's having this rivalry weekend, can you guess who's playing? They wouldn't guess Twins Brewers necessarily, but
whoa.
Here we are.
No,
hey, hold on. We're gonna get to how much we care about or are compelled by these matchups. But no, come on. I think I'm making a reasonable point.
You do make a reasonable point, and I'm sure MLB spent some time thinking about those four teams, right? Braves, Mets, Yankees, Red Sox. Sure. You could have just done Mets, Braves, Yankees, Red Sox this weekend.
Yeah, and we only have what's interesting is because of the way it shakes out. Now, listen, there's no perfect way to do this when you're kind of pot committed on doing all these geographic rivalries. You are going to end up with some non-interleague matchups. So we have 11 interleague and 4 league matchups, including just one, or I guess 2 divisional matchups. Right, we have the Rockies and the D-backs and the Rangers and the Astros, which began last night with a wonderful pitching duel between Hunter Brown and Jacob DeGrom. Before we get to drafting these rivalries that we, based on how compelled we are by them, I do want to give a little bit of a note as to why this is actually possible for the first time. Because this
warning,
is
warning.
Yeah.
Dork bomb incoming. Yes, Jordan Schusterman from the toppest rope.
But also some legitimate reporting as I reached out to Major League Baseball about this a while ago, because this has to do with MOPS. What? What do you mean this has to do with MOPS? None of these are 4-game series, right? Actually, one of them is, I should say, that Rangers Astros is a 4-game series. But that's not what we're talking about. We have seen these matchups in the past few years before. Interleague, of course, since 1997, we've had interleague. But in the last couple of years, interleague's become much more common. And with that, we've seen these series. We've seen Yankees Mets during the season. We've seen, you know, Nationals Orioles, you know, we've seen Cardinals Royals, right? But if you have some memories from these games in recent years, you know, they have normally happened in the middle of the week and they have often only been two games. Okay. So with that in mind, MLB, with this rivalry weekend idea in mind, they wanted to move it to a weekend, and weekends are three game series. All of that sounds good. But what that means is you have to add an additional game on both sides of the rivalry, you know, so two really additional games. And what that does is, for all the hate, right, is takes games away from additional games, away from games against, you know, other random teams in your league. And because of that, one of the outcomes is that there are fewer four-game series, because you don't play four-game interleague series. Those don't exist. Those only happen against teams in your division and teams in your league. And so because of that, you know, the last couple of years when they made interleague very common, four-game series, each team had between 7 and 10 of them a year. Now they only have, most of them only have 6, and there's only about 95 total, whereas the last couple of years there's been about 130 total. So when I noticed that, fewer opportunities. So when I was, you know, sketching out the MOP schedule for the season, I was like, wait, why are there fewer? I asked MLB. They're like, well, it's because we wanted the rivalry series to happen on the weekend. And now here we are.
Is that the first time that you contacted like MLB PR to report something in that way?
I want to say that
if it is, it's perfect. Like,
Well, and part of it was like, there have been other situations where it's like, oh, I kind of wanted that. And then it's a very common thing that someone else has already asked, or someone else already. I was like, Nobody else has asked about this. So I don't think anybody will until I do. And then that when I asked about this at the start of the season, I was like, oh, wait, rivalry weekend. And now here we are. So, okay. So now we have these series. We have three game series on the weekend, which is obviously great. Why would the teams agree to this? Well, because you're going to make a lot more money on the weekend if you have all these geographic rivalry games. So it's a win for everybody. And it's certainly, you know, more compelling than squeezing it into the middle of the week. So now here we are. We have these 15 series. We have these rivalries that range in spiciness. And we're going to pick. We're just going to go ahead and draft them. We're just going to draft the ones that we are most compelled by. One of my hesitations with doing this too, you know, officially, is that we are not, I guess technically we are fans of all 30 teams, because we talk about Major League Baseball and we like to think we could talk about all 30 teams. But the reality is, I'm sure we are going to whiff on the level of importance and how much people care to certain levels. So we can only speak for ourselves. That said, I think the average fan will probably understand why we are choosing some
nicest
over the others.
Nicest caveat ever.
So with that said, here we go. Well, you can have the first pick, Jake. And I think I know what it's going to be, but go ahead.
You actually don't know what it's going to be. My first pick, and I'm thinking about this from what I'd most like to attend, Twins at Brewers.
All right. Incredible. Okay. So tell me why that's your first pick. Now, Twins, by the way, Twins, I know they won 11 in a row. We're going to talk about them a little bit more in our second segment. But for the purpose, keep it focused on this series.
The border battle. Okay. I love a rivalry in the Midwest, but between, like, I first of all, this will be in the tailgating in the parking lot outside AmFam with the Minnesotans and the Wisconsinites. Oh, hey there. Ready to watch Tobias Myers? I guess he's on the IL.
No, he's like, back. He's replacing Jose Quintana. He's going on Saturday. Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, I just, as someone who went to college in that area, general area of the country, the idea of a Twins Brewers three game set sounds like the
I will
best
say,
time.
As someone who's not been to Milwaukee, this would absolutely be one of the first ones I would pick. Not just to see if the Twins can extend their winning streak, to see if the Brewers, who are just a fun team to watch, whether they're good or bad. I get it. How many other of these qualify as border battles? I mean, that would be another thing. Is this the most prolific border battle? There's a couple. I think, unfortunately, right now, due to timing, Tigers Blue Jays is probably the more
different kind of border.
Different kind of border, but certainly a border. other than that, I guess Rockies D-backs technically. But other than that, we don't really have any other I guess DC and Maryland for Nats Orioles.
It's a border fee.
Hell yeah. All these other ones are, of course, in state. So, right, exactly. Anyway, so, okay, Twins Brewers first pick. Wow, amazing. All right, sure.
Winner, put the spotted cow on the line, Wisconsin, if you really believe in it. Twins Brewers.
All right, I'll keep it simple. And especially, it's actually easy for me to take Mets Yankees because you will be there and I won't. So I'm a little bit jealous. You're going to get to see Juan Soto returning to Yankee Stadium. That should be a delight. Obviously, Juan Soto has been very good for the Mets so far, but everyone's like, oh, but he's still a slow start, whatever. It's like, all right, let's get some people booing Juan Soto and see what happens, because I have a feeling it will probably result in a ball ending up over the fence.
I think this is the spiciest Subway Series we've had since the 2000 World Series, because the Mets have been very public about their desire to attempt to encroach on the Yankees' turf. Mm-hmm. The Yankees have run this city for ever. 27 rings will do that. The Mets have been the butt of the joke most of that time. And Steve Cohen, Mets owner, throwing this much cash around to get Juan Soto to Queens, I mean, it's a flag in the turf. It is a statement that says, we want to grow our fan base. We want to become the type of cultural brand that the Yankees have become. Now, can the Mets surpass the Yankees in that regard? It will take time and a lot of championships, but there is a path to that. And if that does eventually happen, we are in year zero of that process. I mean, last year was really year zero in a way. And I think that because of all of that and because of Soto, there will be added spice around this series this year. I know this series is in the Bronx. Mets attendance this year is up 13,000 people per game. Yeah. And I'm curious to see how much of that energy kind of crosses over into people going to Yankee Stadium this weekend.
Sure. But, you know, Yankees fans are going to buy tickets too, and they're going to want to boo Juan Soto. And we look forward to watching that. You will, of course, get to experience it in person. All right, you're up. What's the next pick?
I'm going to go White Sox Cubs. Yep. I know the White Sox stink and the Cubs are good.
Not as stinky. They're not
as stinky. They just took a series from the Reds.
Yeah.
But the Pope, dude. I mean,
this would be the time for the first pitch, right? I guess it's not it's at Wrigley. So I think be better if we could do this, you know, on the south side.
The White Sox now are playing with house money, cathedral money. You know,
White Sox Basilica. They're playing with
Basilica money. You know, they got the Pope on their side. Can't lose.
What's the currency in Vatican City? I don't know.
In the Vatican, there is no currency. You just say, "I'm the Pope."
Well, I'm sure if you're Pope Leo, you don't have to worry about
it. I did look this up. Anything, you know, I looked up. I was curious. Does the Pope get a salary?
Oh yeah.
The answer is traditionally yes, a very small one. Although previous Pope forwent his salary, gave it to charity.
Classic Francis.
Classic Francis, and I think Leo will be doing the same. Anyway, what I loved about researching the White Sox Cubs is how many names it has on Wikipedia. This is known as the Crosstown Classic, the Windy City Showdown, the Chicago Showdown, the North-South Showdown, City Series, Crosstown Series, Crosstown Cup, or Crosstown Showdown. What do you call it, Chicagoans? Email us, baseballbarbecast@gmail.com. I also learned that these two teams used to play a series called the City Series after the regular season just for fun. From like 1900-something to 1943. Whoa. Like for 40 years.
Way longer. So the season ends and they're like, guys, you got to stick around. We got to play the Chicago team.
Exactly. If neither of them won the pennant,
oh my gosh,
they would just play like a 7-game set in early October just for the LOLs. And I think that's pretty sweet. Also, didn't know this, the White Sox lead the all-time series between these teams 78-74.
Yeah.
Which means if the Cubs can win 4 of 6, they will tie. They win 4 of 6 this year. They will tie the all-time season. The all-time series.
To that point, the White Sox welcome the Cubs to the rate at the end of July. So that could be another first pitch opportunity for Leo. That fun fact also will be matched by another one I see you have on here about another one of these rivalries that is generally shocking, but we will get to that in a second. My next pick is going to be Braves at Red Sox.
Why?
Now, I know that geographically, this is not necessarily the one. Yes, we know the Braves, they were in Boston for a long time. But I'm going to focus on the ball here, and I'm going to focus on two teams that have had very strange starts to their seasons. I'm focusing on a Red Sox team that just got embarrassed at the hands of the fighting Tigers one again. Meanwhile, the Braves are back to 500. And this slow start to the season, which now is going to include Ronald Acuña Jr. returning and also Spencer Strider getting back from his weird hamstring injury, and the fact that we're getting Chris Sale against Garrett Crochet tonight is plenty of that. I don't need to overcomplicate it. These are two teams that I think this is an opportunity for the Braves to continue to feel a little bit better about themselves, and for the Red Sox, who again seem to be magnetically tethered to 500, this is a kind of a scary one to have the Braves coming into town. So I'll go with that one.
I fell down a Boston Braves rabbit hole. You know, the Atlanta Braves used to be in Milwaukee, and before that in Boston. They were in Boston for 82 years. Yeah. 82 years they were in Boston. I think
that's enough. That's enough time to make this a thing.
However, the last living Boston Brave, Del Crandall, passed away in 2021. So there are Boston Braves on the earth. I also learned that their stadium, the old Boston Braves Stadium, is the site of Boston University's football stadium. You know, right next to the highway, you drive right by it. It's got the Braves used to play, baby.
There you go. What does this really mean? Are there Boston Braves fans that are still Braves fans? Maybe there's no more players, but presumably there are still Boston Braves fans that are alive.
Are there, if you know of any people living in Boston who are like Boston people, Bruins, Pats, Celtics, Braves, and that the Braves fandom is passed down from like a great grandparent, please let us know. Fascinated by that.
Because again, they're there until 1952. So
it's a bit Dodgers of a stretch. Left in 55.
Yeah, like, or no, I don't know. I would love to know that. So we'll go with that one. But again, it's just those teams are at interesting places right now. So
in a way, like the Dodgers and Giants moving to California, like only a couple of years after the Braves left Boston, overshadows what that probably meant.
Yeah.
And I have
also
no sense.
Also, the other thing about the Boston Braves is how many different names they had. Like, they went back and forth between the Braves and the Bees. And then there were the Doves and the Nationals for some reason. Like, they had a lot of different names during their time.
Were they the Bean Eaters?
The Bean Eaters is not listed on their official. I guess I don't know if that was ever an official.
Yeah, they were from 1883 to 1906. They were the Bean Eaters.
1883. Oh, see, I believe that. I'm just looking at Baseball Reference where it just says Boston. But yeah, no, that's all valid.
Can you imagine if they were the Atlanta Bean Eaters?
I can't. I cannot. What
this,
is
this MF in baseball team eating beans?
What is? Oh, what a reference. What's your next pick?
Woo! I'll take Angels Dodgers, the freeway series. These two stadiums, believe it or not, are actually further apart than the Nats and the Orioles, like the distance.
Oh, wow. That's believable.
Technically, they're both Los Angeles, okay, Angels? two reasons why this one's got some sauce. One, Shohei Ohtani now plays for the Dodgers. The Angels.
I saw that.
Yeah, I don't know if you
saw something about that. Yeah.
Historic missed opportunity. Great article this morning by Ken Rosenthal over at The Athletic about it. Just like the Angels not understanding what they had in Shohei Ohtani, and now they get to watch him play.
They did and they didn't. They just didn't know what to do with it. I mean, they understood because they were like, yeah, Shohei, do whatever you want. And it was awesome. But anyway.
The fun thing here, bet you didn't know this, beautiful listeners.
Yeah.
The Angels have the all-time season series edge. 75-73. A sweep this weekend could put the Dodgers in front for what I assume would be the first time in a long time. I don't think that the Angels have been roaring back in recent seasons.
To my knowledge, it doesn't feel like the Angels have been beaten up on the Dodgers much. So are we sure that doesn't include that exhibition right before opening day?
Not sure.
Okay. I hope not. That's the only time I can remember the Angels winning. Anyway, that's and yeah, I mean, again, we got a little bit more Dodgers chat later. Clayton Kershaw making his season debut on Saturday is very compelling. But the Dodgers are in a weird spot right now, and the Angels are
always
still
in a
quite
weird spot.
quite a bad ball club. So and this is at Dodger Stadium, where the Dodgers are having a damn good time right now. So all right, that's a pretty solid one. Well, if you're going to take Twins Brewers, I'm going to go ahead and take Cardinals Royals.
Yeah.
This is partially also because I've never been to Kansas City and I would love to make an appearance at Kauffman Stadium. This is also partially because of the Cardinals, who are playing quite well. Now, their win streak did end in Philadelphia at the hands of Jesus Luzardo. However, they took the series in Philadelphia, which we said, hey, go win the series in Philadelphia. Then we can really start taking you seriously, Cardinals. We know, of course, the Royals had a very hot stretch. At the same time, I still don't really know how good either of these teams are. And I think that they are both, you know, occupying something of a similar position in their respective central divisions. And I think this will be a nice little litmus test for both teams, especially because the Royals, I know they can pitch. I don't know if they can hit. The Cardinals, I know they can hit. I do not know if they can pitch. So we will see how that matches up here in Kansas City this weekend.
The I-70 series is a funny name for it, considering how enormous I-70 is.
Yes, like claiming
you
I-70
probably
is...
took I-70 to school, right?
Across
Southern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's if that is the same one that stretches all the way.
That's like how you get from DC to Pittsburgh.
Oh yes, down there it is, right? Well, once you get up onto 76, then it's not, but that's true, I guess. Technically, if you're staying like through Ohio, I've spent a lot of time on I-70, more so when I was living in Indiana. This is when I was driving on I-70 over to Dayton, so I know I-70 well. So right, it is a little strange to think about that as Missouri related, but you
the
know
other
highways,
I-70
are, highways
series,
are long.
The other I-70 series is the Indianapolis Indians against the Columbus Clippers.
But see, that one, you know, hits me a little bit more. I've done that drive many times. That one's for me. This one I cannot relate to because I've never been to Kansas City, but I'm compelled by the baseball.
I'll take Nats Orioles next, Beltway series. Okay.
Yeah, I have some beef with this one, but go ahead.
The funny thing about the Beltway series is when you say Beltway, the word Beltway in parlance in this society refers to DC, right? Like,
yes.
Oh, inside the Beltway. You know, like it makes you think of DC. Baltimore has a Beltway all its own. Baltimore Beltway exists and is its own thing. Okay. But the calling it the Beltway series implies that they're both inside one Beltway to me, that they aren't two separate Beltways. Anyway, that's very DMV coded and I apologize. The history here is obvious. The Orioles existed for a long time. The Nats showed up, swallowed up a bunch of their market in the DC area. Orioles, like
the Masson lawsuit series
through Masson for making any money. This quote from Buck Showalter in 2014 that I found cracks me up. Quote, "You realize how big an area Washington was for the Orioles before our owner was kind enough to let them have a team here."
Yeah, I think what's disappointing about this one and why I'm not picking them higher is like, the Orioles stink. And like, I thought we were heading towards a situation, like it's been almost 10 years since these teams were good at the same time. And yeah, right. I mean, there was a stretch there, right? In that era of the Nationals finally being good and the Orioles obviously being one of the best teams in the American League, where you kind of had that. It felt like maybe we could be trending towards it in like 2026 if the Nationals were on track, and now we're kind of back in a not so great situation. Both of these teams are probably bottom five vibes over the last like week and a half. If I mean, obviously the whole season, but like especially the last couple weeks. So in that way, there's kind of some interesting stakes here. The fact that it's at Baltimore, I think, will be a little bit more nerve-wracking, I would say.
Yeah. They got a hashtag, drain both of these swaps.
Well said. I am going to go next with the series that has already began, and that is the Astros and the Rangers. This is also more baseball specific, mostly because we have some pretty compelling evidence that these two teams play entertaining baseball against each other. Now, this is also one of the only divisional series that we have on the board here, so it's kind of cheating. We see this matchup all the time. We've seen it in the postseason. But the fact that we've now had a lot of changeover in some of the characters on these rosters does also compel me. Like Jacob DeGrom against Hunter Brown, like, felt new and
that
cool.
Was great, dude.
And it was great. So I know we're not going to get that again this weekend, but that did kind of, that alone made me be like, all right, I actually might watch some of the series. So, and those are two teams that are trying to get back into relevance and take advantage of the Mariners, remembering that they don't know how to hit. It's different than forgetting how to hit. It's remembering that they never actually knew how to hit all along
in the first place. I'll take Pirates at Phillies, known as the Poop Bowl, because when these two teams used to play on the score bug on NBC Sports Philadelphia, it would be the Pirates P, two zeros for the score, the Phillies P, and that would read poop. And that is funny. These clubs used to be kind of spicier rivals than they are now because they were in the same division for a long time. And there was a stretch from like 1970 through the 80s where they were winning the NL East every year with the 70s Pirates and the 80s Phillies. Like, these teams were dominant and they really went at it. And so when realignment happened, this is a quote from Phillies president Bill Giles from the early 90s. Quote, disappointed at losing the cross-state rivalry, strongly feel Pittsburgh should be in the East because we've had a rivalry with them for 104 years. I just think there's a more legitimate argument for keeping the two Pennsylvania teams together. The cultural rivalry between Philly and Pittsburgh definitely exists in other sports, for sure. I would say the biggest one would be hockey.
I think
the Flyers and do people call them the Gwynns?
<I know. laughs> We were really leaning into it with us calling them the Burrs.
I know.
About Buffalo. This is another one where they haven't been good at the same time. I mean, we know the Pirates have sucked for a long time, but their three-year run of being good is right when the Phillies were ass. So, like, they have at no point overlapped as any sort of compelling thing. But you know what you do get this weekend? Paul Skeens. You get Paul Skeens against the Phillies, so that'll be fun.
Also, a reminder to tell everyone, go watch the Kroll Show. They have a bit called Ponsylvania, which is one of my favorite dumb skits of all time.
Sure. All right. What a wreck.
Last thing about this is, if we ever get realignment, and the Phillies and Pirates are smushed back together in the future, I think this could boil back over in a very interesting way. Okay, I'll kick it to you. A couple more.
I'll do it. I'll take Mariners Padres here. Now, this is one that is...
I hate this one, dude.
So, for those of you who do not know, this one is referred to, very embraced by both sides, as the Vetter Cup. Now, why is it called the Vetter Cup? Vetter, okay, do you know that name? Yes. Eddie Vedder, of Pearl Jam fame, has, I guess, some strong ties to the city of San Diego and the city of Seattle. Okay, great. Now, that's all right. That seems simple enough, right?
Cool.
What's the problem? Eddie Vedder, who, was he born in either of those places? Okay, no, but he grew up in San Diego. And then, of course, Pearl Jam, a very, very heavily associated because they joined in Seattle, Washington. Yep.
What's your favorite Pearl Jam song, man?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to go with Even Flow.
Okay.
Which is a real song by Pearl Jam that I do enjoy. I think it was also partially because it was on Guitar Hero 3.
I have never thought or cared about Pearl Jam ever.
That's fine. I'm not sure how many more songs I could name, but that is a Pearl Jam song I know that I enjoy.
Now, the reason why I hate this is that it is enormous loser energy to me. Because Eddie Vedder, who was born in Chicago and raised there till he was like 13, according to the Wikipedia, is a diehard Cubs fan. Like a huge Cubs fan.
Yeah, not even a secret.
Not a secret. Like, he was around a lot when they won in 16. Yeah. He loves the Cubs. For two teams to name their showdown after a guy who doesn't care about either of them is so weird to me. I don't understand it. I guess it's supposed to be whimsical. I think it's just like, if the Mariners and Padres were successful organizations with a lot of like playoff history, maybe I'd feel differently. But because they have a combined zero World Series titles, I find this to be like huge loser energy.
Yeah. I think for me, it's been more of just like, this is nothing personal against Eddie Vedder, but I've always been like, man, like, That's treating Eddie Vedder like he's like one of the most famous like people in America. And like maybe he is again, this, I'm sure this is disrespectful to a generation of Pearl Jam fans which you listen. So again, we're not going to we can't pretend to be people who we aren't. So that's our perspective. But
hey, whatever. You know what'll get young people interested in Padres Mariners? A Pearl Jam reference.
Right. Now, I will say, there were definitely stretches where this was a series where this would be one of the last series you would pick because of how boring both teams were from 2010 to 2014 or 2013. But now, you know, they at least have fun players. So, you know, Tatis versus Julio. Yeah, I'll tune in for that.
I find it very interesting that you have not picked the Ohio Cup. So I'm going to leave that on the board. And
yeah, I'm mad that it's not in Cleveland. So go ahead. This is more I'm saving it for when they'll be back here.
But Rays at Marlins. If a rivalry falls in the forest, does
Yeah, this is kind of a
if
funky
a rivalry
one.
Falls in a citrus grove.
Yeah, so I don't really know what to make of this one. Obviously, you have two, right? I guess Rockies D-backs is at least somewhat similar in terms of just like teams that just haven't been around that long. And so you don't have as much, you know, what you were just referring to about like the Boston Braves or the Phillies and Pirates having played hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Like this is the opposite of that. Yeah. And it's certainly in terms of the number of people who care. But again, this is another one where maybe I'm wrong. Do people in Florida care about this? I would love to know.
The Phillies and Pirates have played 2,323 times. The Rays and Marlins fewer than that.
I will take the Ohio Cup here. Obviously, adding to the Ohio Cup is Terry Francona, but like I mentioned, that will be a lot more interesting when Terry Francona returns to Cleveland, and that is not happening until later this season. So while this is still, while it will still be talked about a lot, and by the way, this is also two franchises that, of course, have been around for an extremely long time. While they have not played as much because they have not been the same league, it is still something that I appreciate as an Ohio resident who plans to be an Ohio resident for a long time. I will certainly take the Ohio Cup here.
All right, I'll take Giants A's, a series that really is just a bummer now, considering what it has been, what it was, and what it will never be again. And it makes me think about what'll happen in 3 years, 4 years, 10 years if they eventually move to Vegas. Like, is it still going to be Giants A's, or will they have like the A's play the Rockies or the Diamondbacks?
So that's a great question. I think the fact that this is in San Francisco is very important and compelling.
Yep.
Because normally you have this Battle of the Bay. You have A's fans from Oakland who love the A's, want to go support the A's against the Giants. Are those people going to show up this weekend? Do they still exist? We're going to find out. Like? You know, what does that look like? So from that perspective, it is compelling. From the perspective of, is this still a depressing outcome? It is obviously still one of our last picks. Okay, so there's two picks left on the board. We will leave one for I can either select Tigers at Blue Jays or Rockies at Diamondbacks. Now, the argument for Rockies at Diamondbacks is that just there's always weird games happening at Chase Field. And from an entertainment standpoint, there's a decent chance that those games will be interesting. But I'm not going to overthink this. I will take the red hot Detroit Tigers, who are,
I mean,
just a delight to watch under any circumstance. And also, like, I don't know. Tigers, Blue Jays, they are a lot closer geographically than you realize. I drove from Toronto to Detroit. But yeah, I mean, I do think that the Blue Jays fans care way more about beating the Mariners, who are thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away, than they do about the Tigers. So from that perspective, it's probably not as compelling.
Those are the haters.
Yeah.
That's who you should hate. That's who we hate. Let us know if we're wrong. We don't live everywhere, so we don't know. The way to spice this up even more, in my opinion, is to have some of these games played at a neutral site in the geographic location. Right? Now, if you did Yankees Mets at the Garden, hell yeah.
Yeah, Yankee, what are we doing? Yankees Mets at Columbia University?
I mean,
Aaron Judge
would
hit a lot of home runs there.
Dead center. Guardians Reds in Columbus. would be cool. You know,
yeah, like, again, it's just a venue issue, but sure, I guess it would be nice to kind of meet them in the middle in some situations, I suppose. But again, now you they're going to play in both cities, so we're going to have the other side of it.
Rays at Marlins in the Detroit Tigers spring training facility.
And like, I think they'd rather, they'll take the roof if they can get it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to go around the league. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Now it's time to go around the league. Let's begin in the Midwest. Earlier this week, coming off of a couple sweeps, we talked about the Cardinals and the Twins, who were on very impressive winning streaks. Now, since then, the Cardinals have lost a game to the Phillies, but the Twins kept on winning as they sweep the Orioles of Baltimore in Baltimore, including a doubleheader on Wednesday and then a 4-0 win on Thursday, which unfortunately included Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton crashing into each other. As we record this now, it doesn't seem like that is going to result in any sort of long-term absence. We will see. That was a concerning Twinsy moment that we hope will not result in anything more serious. But the point is, the Twins have won 11 games in a row, and the Cardinals have surged to within one game of the Chicago Cubs atop the NL Central standings. And we did wanted to do a little bit further reflection on these two teams and just kind of discuss which one we believe in more. Because standings wise, while the Twins have they both have the same record. They're both 24-20 now. The Twins are in fourth place still because the Guardians and Royals have still been winning, and the Tigers, of course, won again and again and again. So the Twins are five games back of first. The Cardinals are one game back of first. If we look at their Fangraphs playoff odds, I believe the Twins are still in much better position. Now, I know that is a lot because of where they sat before the season, but that is also kind of a way to think about this. But in terms of how they're playing and who's on the team, are you leaning in one direction or the other?
Well, I just think the most important dynamic in terms of the playoff odds is actually the Chicago Cubs' strength of schedule so far and remaining.
Oh, sure.
The Cubs have played the hardest schedule in baseball by a ton, which means they have the easiest schedule in baseball left by a ton. And so I would imagine that is why they are ranked so far ahead of St. Louis in terms of.
Yeah. So, stuff. But also like, Fangraphs love Minnesota coming into the season. So if you look at the playoff odds, like on opening day, the Twins were at, again, this is just to make the playoffs. Twins were at 52% and the Cardinals were at 25%. Now the Cardinals have since only jumped up to 32%. The Twins have jumped up to 60%. Now I think the other relevant part of this conversation is, okay, let's say we believe fully in the Tigers and Cubs and neither of these teams are catching them. The path to a wild card in each of these leagues is very different, most likely. And so while the Cardinals, in some ways maybe have less to deal with in their own division, are they going to beat out these other teams in the NL East and the NL West? That feels like a much taller task than the Twins kind of wiggling their way into the mix in the AL wild card race. But again, we should also talk about like the actual teams involved.
Sure. And I would say that they're hot stretches are both built upon pitching. These clubs have been chucking it over the last couple of weeks. Joe Ryan, Pablo Lopez, and Chris Paddock.
Yeah, Paddock's turning it on. Yep.
He was struggling to start the season. He's looked outstanding in his last handful of starts, just through seven innings without allowing a run, three hits against the Orioles. Like, if he can be a legitimate starter for them, that's enormous. Their offense is still weird in Minnesota, even though they've won 11 in a row. Buxton's been really hot. Correa is still scuffling up a storm.
I don't know what to make of that one, man. Like, he's now kind of gone back and forth here, alternating great and really not great seasons, where, you know, his first year in Minnesota, he was fantastic when he played. 2023, very disappointing. Last year, when he was on the field, he was amazing. He was an all-star, but he only played 86 games. And then now he's kind of back to really scuffling, and you kind of dig into it. I think the thing that stands out the most about Correa is he's not walking at all anymore. He is a career, 10 to 11% walk rate. Right now, that's at 5%. And that's something that even if you are not fully healthy, you're not swinging the bat at your best, like those kinds of skills are normally intact, even if you're not hitting the ball that hard. He's not like striking out a ton. But if he's not getting on base nearly as much, and he's obviously not impacting the ball in the same way that he has, and that's just not a very helpful player right now. And it stands out when you have an offense that is otherwise not super awesome. But obviously, they've got enough production from other guys to win 11 in a row.
And then for the Cardinals, I mean, dude, them rolling into Philly and taking a series is really impressive, including they won a slugfest in that finale. It's like an absolute ugly, back and forth offensive battle. And the things that have been going right for the Cardinals offensively are the things that they kind of hoped would be going right. Mason Wynn has taken yet another step forward at the plate.
Yeah. I was thinking about, this is what I was thinking about the Cardinals, how we were talking about like what teams bang, right? I don't think the Cardinals bang, but they rake. It's a slightly different distinction. You know, there's not as much power in this lineup, but they are collecting hits a lot. And Brendan Donovan certainly exemplifies that. But that's kind of what Mason Wynn does, right? That's kind of what Lars Nootbaar does. That's kind of what Nolan Arenado does at this point in his career. He's not certainly Alec Burleson is a perfect example of that. I know he has been as good this season as he was last year, but he certainly was part of that. And so it's kind of an interesting group. There's really just not a lot of like auto outs in that lineup the way that most teams have.
They're third in baseball and on base percentage behind the Dodgers and the Yankees. They're fourth in batting average. They're ninth in slug.
Yeah,
it's been a good offense so far this year. Lars Nootbaar, also another big part of that. And if they can get Jordan Walker cooking, Gorman cooking, those two guys, they really just have been terrible. Ivan Herrera back, we were all over
he's
that.
He's awesome. Yeah, that's a huge one to kind of get back into the mix. And I will say, though, they have enough good hitters that I'm confident that enough of them will be playing well that they are going to have a good offense. But it's about those second level arms where we just didn't really know whether that's Matthew Liberatore, Liberatore's the big one that I think has to be mentioned as someone where we were kind of getting to the point of like prospect fatigue, like post hype, like is this really ever going to come together? This is someone who was very, very, very highly touted during his amateur and minor league career. And it was just like, is this going to happen here? And before the Cardinals kind of had a changeover in pitching development apparatus, like, this wasn't really a team and an infrastructure that we were going to trust to get the most out of their pitchers. And now that's maybe starting to change.
Friend of the program, Katie Wu, over The Athletic wrote an article about this today. The biggest difference is actually defense. Mm. That is where a lot of these outs are coming from. The Cardinals have had a top three defensive unit so far this year. Last season, they were in the bottom half. And when you have...
That's surprising that they were bad. I always associate them with pretty good defense, but...
They were like fine. But when you have a pitching staff like the one they have,
not a lot of strikeouts.
Has so many balls in play and is not a big strikeout, right? Miles Michaelis, Andre Pallante, Eric Fetty, they're going to rely on their defense to get the ball to get outs. And the defense was last year, and now they're kind of back to being sensational. I think that is a huge development for the Cardinals and one that I think could sustain.
Steven Matz has been shockingly effective as a reliever. Like, good for him. Like, again,
you know what I learned recently?
Yeah.
Steven Matz's wife is a musician who wrote the song that is Brandon Nimmo's walk-up song.
Wow. I don't even know how to... I should have so many more follow-up questions, but I'm so shook by that fun fact that I'm just going to let it sit. Let people understand what you just said there. Steven Matz... I mean, Steven Matz and Brandon Nimmo go way back, so that part's not that surprising.
Steven Matz's wife is in a band. That band is Steven Matz's wife and her two siblings, I believe. Oh, they have a song. I think it's called I'm So Blessed.
And that sounds that like a Brandon Nimmo walk-up song. I would say if you had me to pick what Brandon Nimmo's walk-up song would be called, that would be one of my first guesses. Anyway, Steven Matz has been very good. And so have the St. Louis Cardinals. As we mentioned, Cardinals in Kansas City this weekend. Twins. Now, the last thing I'll say about Twins, and then we'll move to the Dodgers, is they just did this last year. They won, was it 13 in a row, 14 in a row last year? It was a little bit earlier. It was like at the end of April into May. But that's part of where it's like, oh, is this the sign of a special team? It's like, it's definitely too early to determine that. Let's just be glad they are collecting all these wins, albeit against some not so good teams, including last year it was sweeping the White Sox twice, including I think one of them was a mop. This year they swept the Orioles twice in the same winning streak. So tough look for Baltimore, but Minnesota, you will stack the wins wherever you can get them. We will see if they can continue to prove it against Milwaukee this weekend. All right, let's go back out west and talk about the Dodgers. So,
sure.
Two major updates for this team. Let's first actually talk about, especially after last night, let's talk about the promotion, the call-up, and the major league debut of one Dalton Rushing, their top prospect. I guess technically Roky Sasaki was their top prospect coming into the season, but at this point we know that I guess he is still that. He is very much still a prospect. lots to be to project. Anyway, Dalton Rushing. He's a big leaguer now.
Friend of the program. Congratulations.
He has been on this podcast before. He joined us at the 2023 Futures game, told a fantastic story about finding out that he was getting drafted by the Dodgers, which I encourage people to go back and listen to. We had just like a Futures game. There's a lot of fun interviews on that one with like Marcelo Meyer and Jordan Lawler, a bunch of stuff. So you can go back to that July. It's on the same feed, July of 23. You can go listen to that. But Dalton Rushing is an awesome player, a really, really, really cool story. Someone who at Louisville was kind of hidden behind Henry Davis, who of course ends up being the first overall pick. And by the time he kind of gets his breakthrough in 2022, you know, the year after Henry goes first overall, it's like, it felt like he kind of came out of nowhere, but he had done it on the Cape. He has this huge season and the Dodgers take him 40th overall. And all he's done, all this dude does is hit. I mean, it's as cliche as it gets, but he is a power and on-base machine. His first hit last night was a 110 exit velo, which is extremely impressive for your first career hit. A single up the middle, draws a bunch of walks, and he can catch. Now, his development as a catcher has been certainly interesting because he's in an organization that has this catcher in Will Smith, also from Louisville, extended for a decade, right? Like, it doesn't seem like an obvious path to him being a starting catcher, but he has always hit enough and has shown enough defensive versatility, a little bit of time in the outfield, a little bit of first base, where it was like, we cannot give up on this guy, especially when catchers are so volatile. And he hit his way to the big leagues. And now, in a very interesting decision, the Dodgers have finally decided to move on from their longest time backup catcher, probably one of the longest tenured backup catchers like anywhere ever. Like, I feel kind of comfortable saying that for someone to hold on to this job in one place for this long. They move on from Austin Barnes, and now Dalton Rushing is going to be the backup catcher, which is an unusual position to be in, but kind of like Drake Baldwin in Atlanta, he is too good of a hitter to just not have those at-bats at your disposal every couple days. And I'm glad that, like in Atlanta, even when Sean Murphy came back, they were like, no, we need this guy around. We'll find ways into the lineup. And I think they're going to do the same thing with Dalton.
And I think that's a great comparison because both those teams have their DH spot clogged up.
Yeah, good point. Yep.
Where the Braves have Ozuna and the Dodgers have Ohtani. For a lot of situations, right, you would bring this guy up and you would have him catch twice a week and DH twice a week, and it would be fine. He'd get his at bats. But because they can't do that, it'll make things a little bit more complicated. It's a reminder of how teams view catching. I had a front office person explain to me recently that they called it a tertiary position group. There are pitchers, there are hitters, and there are catchers. And for the catchers, it is not just the framing and the blocking and the throwing. It is the pitch calling. It is the pitcher handling. And for a team like the Dodgers that is perpetually in contention, for whom the handling of pitchers is held to such a high standard, Dalton Rushing had a higher bar to clear here in order to prove his readiness for the big leagues. I think in a lot of other organizations, he would have been up last year, right? A lot of organizations, he would have made the team out of camp. but they just did not feel like he was prepared to do that part of the job quite yet. They ran him through kind of like a onboarding, great article from Fabian Ardaya over at The Athletic about it, like how they slowly onboarded rushing into that experience. There are catchers in baseball history who could really hit, who never really got the opportunity to learn how to catch because their team was contending when they came up. I think about Francisco Mejia in Cleveland. Like, there's a scenario where, like, Kyle Schwarber, who caught, comes up on a bad Cubs team with that has nothing to play for, and his Wilson Contreras doesn't exist, and, like, he gets a chance to try that, right? And I think that it is so context dependent for any player, but even more so for a catcher.
But I also think it's important that as good of a hitter as they are, and while you could look at their outfield situation in both Atlanta, I mean, especially in Atlanta, but also in LA, and say, why don't you just put him in the outfield? And they're saying, no, he's a catcher. We want him to catch. And even catching twice a week is extremely valuable experience to remain a catcher. Because the reality is, while Will Smith is extended for a long time and is still one of the best catchers in baseball, he isn't going to catch forever. And he is someone that you could certainly imagine moving to a second base, a third base at some point down the line. And you do not want to give up on Dalton Rush, the catcher, because if he can develop as a defender, what an incredibly valuable player that is. And that's the same thing goes for Drake Baldwin. But just because you want to rush that bat into the lineup, it's not necessarily worth what the upside you would be sacrificing of having this guy be an everyday catcher, even if it doesn't happen until 2027. And so I'm glad that Dalton is getting that opportunity. I'm excited to catch up with him when they come to Cleveland. I know you'll see him when they go to New York a little bit before then, but he's been one of my favorite players since he was at Louisville, and getting to know him a little bit better, like, he's so ready for this and understands the situation so well that I think he has the right mentality to tackle it. And as always with teams like this, like, it's just fun to see new characters in the Dodgers. It's really that simple. We've just watched this team so much. We just saw them won the World Series. Like, this is why it's been so fun to get to watch Kim, you know, and now get to watch rushing. Like, these are new people on this team is going to be very, very, very interesting. Now, the opposite speaking of a new character.
Speaking about new people on this team, Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah. So Clayton Kershaw will be making a season debut on Saturday. That is exciting because Clayton Kershaw is one of the greatest pitchers of all time, and any opportunity we get to watch him is an important and cool one that we should not take for granted. Clayton Kershaw made 5 rehab starts. Remember, he was coming back from, I believe, multiple surgeries, right? He had dealing with his knee and then dealing with his toe, I think, were the surgeries from the offseason. You know, last year he was coming back from the shoulder issue, and he only made, 7 starts in the regular season?
7 and starts, and it was the first time since his rookie season that the results were bad. Yes. Again, only 7 starts, but he had a 4.50 in 30 innings. He didn't really strike anybody out, and he got hit pretty hard.
Well, he's throwing not fast. Obviously, he is not throwing fast at all. In fact, he in his 5 rehab starts in the minors, he maxed at 89, averaged around 87, which even compared to last year is a little bit down. But hey, in the minors, he still had, you know, a low ERA, and even though he was, you know, working on stuff. So the reason that, I mean, Clayton Kershaw is going to be compelling in any context, no matter what. That said, as we bring in the other bit of news, which is that Roki Sasaki is now on the IL, joining the gaggle of Dodgers arms who are already injured. Specifically Dodgers shoulders that are already injured. It's been a lot of shoulder. I know we've spent a lot of time talking about the elbow. It's been a lot of shoulder issues for the Dodgers recently. They need Clayton Kershaw, which we really did not expect to have to say about almost any.
Wrong.
Okay. So, all right. Incorrect. They don't need him. All right. Never mind. They don't. So here's the thing, man. Like, I don't understand. Like, am I still going to expect the Dodgers to find a way to win the division? Yes, I do. All I am saying is it has been thinned out. Now, what has helped is that Tony Gonsolin looks great. Dustin May, not as good recently. They have guys. So what I'm saying is, like, Clayton Kershaw is going to have to make more starts this year than I would have expected. Is that a fair thing to say? I feel like I don't know what they would have done had all of these guys been healthy and he was ready to go here in the middle of May. if they were going to shoehorn him into a 6 or 7 or 8 man rotation. Like, I don't know what would have happened. This is how it has worked out. I just, again, this is not the scenario where I would have thought that Clayton Kershaw was going to be coming back. But I am excited to see what that looks like.
The stakes are not that high for any singular thing related to the Dodgers that is not named Shohei Ohtani. And because of that, they're a difficult thing to cover because they don't matter. They're treating the regular season like it is spring training. At the same time, there is a point, right, where enough stuff will go wrong where we have to be concerned. I just don't think we're even close to that yet.
No, I mean, I think that's
by
fair.
Last night's, you know, 19-2 obliteration of the A's, they are just so much more talented than most teams, and that will get them through.
I agree. Again, it's just we have still already made it a very far way from the way we were talking about this pitching staff at the start of the season. That's really all I am trying to say. Is that now they're going to ask Clayton Kershaw to throw a bunch of innings, which would be cool. And I hope it goes well. But also, like, yeah, how does this go? Regardless of how much it impacts the Dodgers playoff odds, like, can he continue to do this in some form where he is throwing 88 miles an hour? Like, maybe he's one of the greatest of all time. And he has had success with diminished velocity, but last year was not an especially promising sign. So we will see what it looks like this time around.
Last thing about Kershaw, his ERA currently sits at a crisp, lovely to look at, 2.50 career.
Boy. Yep.
Jacob DeGrom has a 2.51 career ERA. Kershaw's ERA is the lowest in the integration era with a pitcher with at least like 100 starts. I mean, you could lower it to like, if you lower it to 30, it's Paul Skeens, which is amazing.
I mean, like, sure.
You know,
well, of course, right? If you mess with the minimums, but
Kershaw with a stinky season could fall down the all-time ERA list.
But see, it would have to be really stinky because you say 100 starts, the guy's got almost 3,000 innings, so it would take some really, really, like, it took years for Albert Pujols to like make a negative dent in his overall numbers. There's almost nothing that can happen to Kershaw this season where it is going to mean, yes, maybe it goes up from 250, but it hits, you know, the hay's in the barn there. I don't think it's going to impact it too much.
All right, let's take a break. We probably should give Evan Longoria, Matt Carpenter, and Tony Kemp more time, but we don't have it. Congratulations on great careers,
yeah,
my dudes.
These are great careers. I'm glad Longoria is retiring as a Ray. Matt Carpenter, I will never forget, like, obviously a Cardinals legend, but like the Yankees run is one of the more inexplicable. Like, I look forward to opening Matt Carpenter's baseball reference page in 8 years and remembering what happened in that stretch with the Yankees, because it was one of the more absurd hot streaks that has existed since we have been doing this. And I don't think we can ever take that away from them. And then Tony Kemp, I just wanted to shout Tony Kemp out, because Tony Kemp, who is a very lovable, likable guy, who, by the way, was on the Vanderbilt broadcast last night, and Vanderbilt hit a walk-off home run, which is very cool. Tony Kemp, in his retirement statement, said, share your memories of like watching me as a player. Like, I would love to just hear from fans and whatever. And I actually do have a very specific one. Now, this probably isn't a very positive memory for Tony Kemp, but it is one that is like seared into my mind. When Cal Raleigh hits the walk-off home run to clinched the postseason spot. That was, of course, against the Oakland A's. And Tony Kemp, after that moment, as the Mariners were celebrating on the field, this is like when they have their t-shirts, everything. Tony Kemp is sitting in the outfield watching for pretty much the entire time. And Tony Kemp, who at that point is, of course, on this A's team, he was on the A's for a long time. He had, you know, was a team that was very bad at that point. But you could understand that Tony Kemp, you know, understood the moment that he was kind of witnessing. And I just remember that so well, you know, because I was there and just watching Tony. I've never really seen that before a player. You know, sometimes you see a guy in the dugout kind of looking over when the season's over. But the season wasn't over for the A's. It wasn't the last game of the season. But he just kind of sat out there and watched it. And I just will always remember that. And I thought that spoke to just Tony Kemp kind of understanding ball, and I'm excited to kind of see how he progresses as a personality.
He also only appeared in three playoff games.
Well, that's part of it, too, is it was also kind of a tragic thing because I think he only appeared in the postseason with the Astros early in his career.
In 2018.
And was kind of ended up on some of these really, really bad teams. And so, but he still had a great career and still found a way to impact a lot of people. And so that was also part of it. So kind of a poignant moment. But there you go, Tony Kemp. There's my memory of you in kind of a weird way. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, the good, the bad, the ugly.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. It is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'm going to go first because I'm selfish. Go ahead.
Something good. Let's hear it.
Great article this week from Blake Murphy over at Sportsnet about umpire Scott Barry. Did you see this?
Yes. I didn't read this. I saw this is open on my phone. I have not read it yet. So I'm excited about this. Go ahead. Tell me more.
MLB softens rule after umpire Scott Barry honors late wife with tattoo. And this is not something I knew, but before this season, umpires were not allowed to have tattoos that were in the open. They could have them and they could cover them up with long sleeves, but they could not have tattoos. Like they were getting into a, you know, Japanese hot bath. And that rule was changed over this offseason in part because Scott Barry, a longtime umpire, got a pretty sick tattoo on his right sleeve, basically all the way down his arm, in honor of his late wife, Christine, who passed away from cancer. And the league, the umpires union, in acknowledgement of that, you know, the MLB UA changed the ruling. And now Scott Barry is allowed to showcase that and honor his wife. And this is just a cool story with some great quotes from Blue Jays players, because Blake is up in Toronto. Highly recommend reading it. Good.
Like, cool. That is
it
good.
It is good that society changes its perception of certain rules over time as we become more empathetic in some ways.
Yeah, that's true. My good this week is the Royals signed Rich Hill. Rich Hill,
who talking about being empathetic.
Rich Hill, who turned 45 years old in March, is now on the Royals for some reason. I don't really know where Rich Hill fits on the Royals, even if he somehow manages to pitch well anytime soon. But I'm sure I've said that about Rich Hill signing with other recent teams. The point is, this is important because should Rich Hill make it to the major leagues with the Kansas City Royals, it would be the 14th different major league team that he appears for, which would indeed tie Edwin Jackson's famous record for most franchises played for in the big leagues. The likelihood of this happening, I don't know. Like I said, the Royals pitching staff seems to be doing just fine without a 45-year-old left-hander, but I hope that it happens because Rich Hill has bounced between teams. We've already seen him on plenty in recent years, and to see him maybe don a new uniform would really be something special. So, Rich Hill, good luck, sir. That is my good.
My bad is a tweet from a walk-off. This is from @bsun on Twitter. It is a video of Eloy Jimenez hitting a walk-off single off Craig Kimbrell.
Oh, boy.
Eloy and Craig Kimbrell, neither of them are in the major leagues. They are both former members of the White Sox dynasty from 2020 to 2021. and now neither of them are with the White Sox anymore. Kimbrell is in AAA with the Gwinnett Stripers, the Braves affiliate, and Eloy is in AAA with the Durham Bulls, the Tampa Bay Rays affiliate. But what makes this video even better? This walk-off single from Eloy through the right side to win the game for the Bulls is that Eloy is wearing a SpongeBob SquarePants uniform. It is SpongeBob yellow. It looks like SpongeBob. The tweet from this White Sox fan says, Eloy walking off Kimbrell and SpongeBob uniforms just about sums up the last 4 years.
That sounds pretty good to me. I don't know why that's bad, but
it is if you're a White Sox fan.
Yeah, no, that's very valid.
But you got the
yes, well said. My bad this week is the behavior of some of the other individuals who were banned from baseball and have since been unbanned from baseball. Now, here's the deal. We obviously spent a lot of time on Wednesday talking about Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson. And we talked about Pete Rose and many reasons why this does not seem like a human that we would want to celebrate. And I understand that. Shoeless Joe Jackson, we really didn't spend a lot of time on. I'm not going to spend too much time on the Black Sox scandal throwing the World Series in 1919. The very famous thing that happened. Now, you may have seen in the headlines that there were a lot of other banned individuals on the permanently ineligible list who, of course, has long been deceased. And this is, remember, it's a policy change. And so it's not just about Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson. It is that if you are on the banned list and you are no longer with us, you are now reinstated. Okay.
These other people are not famous because they're not getting into the Hall of Fame. Because
correct. They do not have great numbers like Shoeless Joe Jackson and Pete Rose. So then I was like, oh, okay, well, who are these people? Now, what half of them are. What did they do? Okay, so right. So about half of them were just other Black Sox. Okay, so I'm not going to run through all that. I mean, again, a lot of interesting things with that. Then there's like another handful that were just also involved in gambling related, you know, not good
nonsense.
Choices. Or like throwing games, like not good. Okay. But there's two of them that I need to hide.
Oh,
one of them I'm not going to spend that much time on because our dear friend and former recent podcast guest, Michael Clare, wrote an extremely awesome article about him a few years ago. That gentleman's name is Benny Kauf. Benny Kauf, who at one point, I believe, led the Federal League in war. This dude was like an awesome player. Okay. He was called the Ty Cobb of the Federal League. But the reason that Benny Kauf got... Yeah.
It says Ty Cobb of the Feds, which is amazing.
Ty Cobb, which is even funnier. Speaking of the Feds, this is what happened to Benny Kauf, okay? Benny Kauf was involved. He owned like an automobile shop because when you were playing at this time, you just had other side jobs because you weren't making that much money playing baseball.
Yep.
And essentially, he ended up getting basically charged with selling a stolen vehicle. He sold a car that it turned out that his associates had like repainted and like had stolen and repainted and sold it. So he eventually ends up getting acquitted by that charge. But the commissioner is like, no, like you can't be trusted. Like you, this is still and just never reinstated him. So even though it was like kind of unclear whether he actually did this, Benny Kauf, B4L, because he was associated with possible selling stolen cars. Okay, so that's already
that is a hilarious. Two thoughts on that. Fast and Furious 1 ass crime.
Bingo, right. But, you know, you said two, speaking of the feds, not good.
Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was the commissioner at the time,
yeah,
whose whole thing was to rule with an iron fist to clean up the sport, maybe went a little too far here.
Yes. Now,
let Benny cook.
Yes, so Benny, and again, just Google Benny Kauf, Michael Clare, read the whole story. It's so good. Okay.
Fast and
but
Furious
the other
11,
one, the
Benny
other
Kauf.
One is the one that I am so excited to talk about. Phil Douglas. Phil Douglas.
Philly
Phil
Dougie.
Douglas was a great pitcher in the early 20th century. And Phil Douglas did not like his manager, John McGraw. Okay.
Oh,
now,
no.
Phil Douglas had a lot of off the field issues because he was an alcoholic, and this led him to a lot of very poor decisions along the way. But generally, he was able to have a successful career for most of his 20s to the point where he wins the 1921 World Series with the New York Giants and John McGraw. All right. Phil Douglas, he's a very good pitcher, right? Phil Douglas in 1922. Hates his manager so much because Phil Douglas was just constantly getting in these fights with his manager, John McGraw, and legendary manager, about his behavior and like how much he could be trusted on the road because he was always drinking and never doing all these things, right? And Phil Douglas decides, I do not want to play for this team anymore. Okay.
Okay.
Now, this is now ends up being a generally kind of tangentially related to throwing games, but this is how he does it. Okay.
This is like a Derek Bender situation.
I do not want to be on the team anymore. Okay.
Great.
He reaches out to a former teammate on the St. Louis Cardinals. He writes him a letter.
Oh.
And he says,
kids these days could never.
Okay. He basically is like asking him, like, hey, if you can give me enough money, I will just disappear. Okay. In the middle of the season. But the letter is the best part, okay? I'm just going to read this excerpt from the Wikipedia. Phil Douglas. I want to leave here, but I want some inducement. Okay, so that's the problem, because he's basically saying, like, pay me and I'll go in. He says, I don't want this guy to win the pennant. I feel if I stay here, I will win it for him.
Oh.
If you want to send a man over here with the goods, I will leave for home on the next train. I will go down to fishing camp and stay there. So Phil Douglas is like, I'm done. I'm too good. I don't want to help him win the World Series. And so eventually this letter, which he wrote like a total dummy, finds its way to Kenesam Outlandis, who's like, yeah, no, you're gonzo. Bans him. The funniest part of all of this, they still win the World Series.
Oh,
even without him. So even though he gets banned in the middle of the season. Even though he did not contribute to the 1923 World Series, John McGraw was like, great, Phil, I don't even care. We don't want you around. We'll win it without you.
Can you imagine?
And that, like, is what got him banned for life.
Tony Gonsolin sends a letter to, like, you know, AJ Hinch.
Yes. And this is why it was almost my ugla, but my ugla is also funny. But that line just killed me. I don't want this guy to win the pennant. I feel if I stay here, I will win it for him. Is just an all-timer. So anyway, but hey, reinstated. Phil Douglas, put him on the Veterans Committee. I might vote for him. He seemed like a pretty good pitcher.
Now, Phil Douglas did kind of carve in 1922 to his defense.
He did before he, but that was the problem. Yeah. He was like, I'm too good. I'm going to help them win the World Series.
I love that his nickname was Shufflin' Phil.
Oh, yes.
Because of his slow gait from the bullpen to the mound.
Yeah. So anyway, bad behavior. This is in bad. I'm not condemning doing this. I don't want baseball players to do this. Condoning. Sorry.
You are condemning.
I am condemning. I was like, I said that. I was like,
you're not condoning. I'm
not condoning.
Condoning. Yeah, I am condoning. And not you're condoning. I love this.
You do love this. You wish more players would do this, where they say, I don't want to. Yeah.
But only in writing.
Yeah, so that Rob Manfred could find it and reban you, at least while you're alive. Okay, Phil Douglas, that's my bad. What's your ugly?
I got a record under threat, Jordan.
Uh-oh.
What's one of our favorite records in baseball history all time? We celebrated it while we were live on the air once. It is Albert Pujols' career double plays grounded into.
Yes. Okay. Yes, yes.
Albert Pujols, besides being a future Hall of Famer, one of the greatest players of all time, he leads MLB history in one stat and one stat only, and it is GIDP, 426 career double plays grounded into. That is an absolute ton. He averaged 22 double plays grounded into per year over a 22-year career. The all-time single-season record is held by Jim Rice, also a Hall of Famer, who hit into 36 double plays in 1984. Junior Caminero of the Tampa Bay Rays has already grounded into 11 double plays so far this season as a 21-year-old. At that rate, he is currently on pace to break Jim Rice's record of 36. He's like right on the line there. Caminero, who hits the snot out of the ball to the pull side, the right side. He is slow, okay, and he hits the ball on the ground more than you would like. Those are all the conditions perfect for a player capable of, and he's also good and young. He's going to get every chance to hit. Capable of making a run at it. And that is the thing with Caminero. Caminero won't play 22 years, but he could. He's got a better shot than basically any other guy just because of when he debuted. He's only 21. So it is early. We said similar things about Cody Bellinger and Barry Bonds one time. But Junior Caminero making a play at both the single season and eventually the career record for double plays grounded into. That is my ugly.
I am so glad you mentioned that. And you might say, oh, well, that's not a good sign for Junior Caminero. To which I would say, take a look at Manny Machado's career. Because Manny Machado is the other guy who it sees. I don't think he's going to catch Albert Pujols because he's many far behind. But that's kind of if Junior Caminero has Manny Machado's career and grounds into what Manny Machado, who is the active leader with 213 double plays, that's great. That's awesome. That's fine. You can keep grinding those double plays because that also means that you are going to have many, many hits and homers and RBIs and stuff.
Jordan, Manny Machado, literally half of Pujols.
I know.
Exactly.
But he's still under contract for a while. So if he can get back to doing it, 20, 30 times a year, maybe. But no, Caminero's a good one. All right, my Ugla, we go back to the world of college baseball. By the way, very exciting. My NAIA one from last week, all three of those teams that I highlighted, they have advanced to the World Series. So Shreveport is 54-0. Georgia Gwinnett stole 15 more bases in the regional. They are advancing. Charlie Muniz hit two more home runs. So he's at 113 Great. Home runs for his Cumberland's career. They will all be in Lewiston, Idaho for the NAIA World Series. But Great. No, my Ugla is a game that happened last night. Last year, Shohei Ohtani went 6-for-6 and got to 50-50, and it was one of the greatest games of all time. There is a game that happened last night, a box score for a player that, while the stakes and the number of people watching does not rival Shohei Ohtani, obviously, this was rather remarkable. This was a game between Wright State and Purdue Fort Wayne.
You were locked
in. I was not watching this. I saw this right as I was falling asleep, and I was like, holy crap, I can't believe this happened. Justin Osterhaus, the third baseman for Purdue Fort Wayne. What does he do in the first inning? He hits a home run. We love that for Justin Osterhaus. That's great. That's a good way to start any game, right? He puts Purdue Fort Wayne up 2-1.
That's the Ugla.
That's the game. That's it. That's the Ugla. Oh, no. Okay. So the game continues, and Justin Osterhaus he gets a single in the second, and then he hits another home run in the bottom of the fourth, and they're up 6-2, but then Wright State just starts pouring it on, and now Purdue Fort Wayne at Wright State's dominating the Horizon League, and now they have a big lead. So now Osterhaus comes up and he homers again, so third homer of the game. But the problem is that they're down a bunch. His homer makes it 12-7 Wright State. And so you're like, all right, well, whatever. Okay, three homer game. You're still getting your ass whooped. Like, who cares? The game proceeds. And at this point, Purdue Fort Wayne is out of pitchers. So they're like, hey, Justin, you're having a great time hitting. Why don't you just go out there and pitch the ninth? You're down 17-10. Can you just go out there and give us an inning? Because we just need someone to cover. And he's like, yeah, sure, fine, whatever. Justin Osterhaus goes out, throws a scoreless top of the ninth. Okay, great. It's 17-10. Going to the bottom of the ninth. Justin Osterhaus just pitched, okay? Here comes, well, they're down. They're down 7-0. But yes, if they can come back. Single, double, hit by pitch for Justin Osterhaus in his first at-bat of the inning, but not his last. Single, walk, pitching change, walk, single, strikeout, double, single, single. And here comes Justin Osterhaus in a tie game. With the bases loaded, having just pitched the top of the ninth and already hit three home runs. God. And he hits a grand slam. So, to be clear, Justin Osterhaus finishes the day with four home runs, a walk-off grand slam, and is the winning pitcher after an 11-run inning at the bottom of the ninth. Justin Osterhaus. Ugla. All right.
Good day at the yard. Well,
that was fun. Yeah, good day at the yard. Like I said, just like go back, play again tomorrow. All right, that was fun.
That's the best part about baseball is you just go out there the next day, play duty. That's the best part about baseball. It's the next day you go out there, go 5-for-6 with a walk-off grand slam and get the win. It's every day.
Oh, my gosh. All right. That's
and this
show.
Win
Thank
moved
you,
Purdue Fort Wayne to 11-38.
All right, like, they're awful. This is like probably the greatest game in program history. All right. Thank you, TJ Brassel, for producing this beast of an episode.
Monster.
Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, about the rivalries. That feels like so long ago that we talked about that. This was such a fun show. We will be back on Monday. Everyone have a wonderful weekend. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.